This is for the men who never settle. The ones who believe only quitters end a game in a tie. The type of guys who choose the bar with the biggest TVs to overcompensate for theirs at home. This is the Lodge mentality. This is Twin Peaks.
Gerritsen and Toth presents The Shift with Jack Johnson on ESPN Kansas City, 1510 AM and 94.5 FM.
We are back with another edition of The Shift on 94.5 FM and 1510 AM ESPN Kansas City. I'm your host, Jack Johnson, alongside Marco Marquez. Shout out to our presenting sponsors, starting with Gerritsen and Toth. They handle the most complex felony, federal, or state criminal defense cases. You'll find they've been doing that successfully, helping criminal defendants all over the Kansas City area and Northeast Kansas for years. Also, a shout out to Active Family Chiropractic. Dealing with any neck, back, shoulder, or any type of pain, go in today and schedule an appointment. Their office is located on 135th and Antioch in Overland Park, Kansas. Or just give them a call at 913-681-6013. That's 913-681-6013. Stop dealing with those nagging pains that keep you up at night and call Active Family Chiropractic today. You hate to put this much emphasis on a Royals game that is not even in June, July, or August, but I think you'd find a hard time, or you'd have a hard time finding any other Royals game like the one yesterday that had massive implications on what could happen for the next 2 or 3 months. So in a rubber match against the Colorado Rockies, you have Daniel Lynch on the bump going up against Austin Gomber. You had just gotten shelled the night before. I have different feelings about that Saturday game and throwing Carlos Hernandez for the seventh time. But you get shelled 10-4. You win game one 14-10. It was an offensive shootout every single game in Colorado. But on Sunday, despite it being a day game at Coors Field, which Ryan LaFever pointed out in the broadcast that it's the hardest place to pitch in Major League Baseball, not just at Coors Field, but during the day. The ball flies in the thin air. So Daniel Lynch is on the bump, Austin Gomber for Colorado. Daniel Lynch gives you 5 1/3 scoreless innings, only 3 hits, 4 strikeouts, 4 walks. The young kids were the ones that produced pretty much all the offense in the first 7 innings. You know, except for a home run by Whit Merrifield, Emmanuel Rivera had a 2-run home run. Bobby Wood Jr. had a home run, back-to-back games with a home run. You know, MJ Melendez had a couple of good plate appearances. But it was the young kids getting it done. Daniel Lynch, Bobby Wood Jr., Emmanuel Vera. Emmanuel Vera had 3 RBIs on 2 hits. But Bobby Wood Jr. has a 427-foot home run. Just crushed it. Whit Merrifield's heating up. He has another 2-hit game. And you feel great. It's 6-0. It's the top of the 7th. And you go, we're getting out of the Mile High City with a series win against a pretty competitive NL West team. You get back to Kansas City with a 4-5 road trip, not what you wanted. You know, I said that with the spot you were at before the 9-game road trip, I would have wanted to see 6-3. You couldn't get there, but 4-5 is a hell of a lot better than 3-6. 3 straight series losses on the road. You're not having much confidence coming back to Kansas City. But in the bottom of the 7th inning, not only did the Royals have their worst inning of the season, they might have had their worst inning of the last 5 years. Now, I compared it to that game in Baltimore last year, where the Royals, I believe, were in the 6th inning, and they had a 5 or 6 run lead and completely blew it, and they lost to Baltimore. And that was the Orioles. So maybe I'll give that inning the worst because the Royals were nearly out of it, and Hunter Dozier dropped a fly ball in right field. So maybe I'll give that nod to the worst inning in the last 5 years. But this was easily the worst inning of any year, of any season, excuse me. Or I'm getting that wrong as well. Of the year, not of any year. This was the worst inning of the year for Kansas City. 7 runs, you used 3 pitchers. Colin Snyder worked 2/3 of an inning. Amir Garrett worked 1/3 of an inning. He had to try to get at least 1 out for Colin Snyder. He did that on his first batter, then walked 2 consecutive guys. Then Taylor Clark was a complete disaster. 2/3 of an inning, 4 runs, 2 earned. every two-strike pitch was just slapped into the outfield. The Rockies were using a very good two-strike approach to not only make this game competitive once again, but eventually take the lead. And everything the Royals were doing up to that point completely just fell in shambles. Every defensive miscue started happening. No pitcher was attacking the strike zone. They weren't getting any true soft contact that were resulting in outs. I mean, it was ugly. And that felt like a moment in the season, though it would have been just 32 games in, where it cost somebody their job. I've said that a few times of, you know, this and that, that's going to cost somebody their job. Being shut out three times in five games should cost somebody their job. Losing in this fashion on a day in which it's the final game of the road trip and you can take the series, losing in that fashion would have cost somebody their job. So the Rockies get seven in the bottom of the seventh after trailing 6-0. And you think, man, can it get much worse? Buddy Bell says, I never say it can get much worse, but it felt like rock bottom in that bottom of the seventh inning. You know, as sure-handed of a fielder as you have, and Nicky Lopez makes a brutal error in that seventh inning. You know, with one out, he makes a great play in the hole at second base, and instead of taking the for sure out at one, he tries a jump throw to second, which skips to Bobby Witt Jr., who couldn't pick it. And that's in a moment where usually Nicky Lopez, 9.9 out of 10 times, is going to make the right play, the heads-up play. And the heads-up play in that moment is not the spectacular play. It's you're trying to get just one out. You're struggling to get out to that point. If it gives them a run, that's okay. But your momentum's already leading you to first base. Yes, it's a slow runner running to second base, but you just need one there. He tried to be the hero, go to two. Was a bad throw. Bobby Witt Jr. couldn't pick it. So they get those seven. The Royals don't score in the top of the eighth. Colorado doesn't score in the bottom of the eighth, thanks to a scoreless inning from Josh Staumont, a great defensive play in the outfield by Michael A. Taylor. So you go into the top of the ninth with some jobs on the line. And if it weren't for some late-game heroics, we would be having a much different conversation this morning. So Andrew Benintendi, ice cold off the bench, comes in against Daniel Bard, a guy that touches 99 with regularity. A wipeout slider, and he works a five-pitch walk. He gets on base. Then Ryan O'Hearn comes up in place of Nicky Lopez. And for as much hate as we give Ryan O'Hearn, and I've been somebody that's done it, the one thing Ryan O'Hearn has done well is not respond to that criticism in any negative light, because he knows he's not playing well, he knows he's not hitting well, and he knows that majority of Kansas City does not want to see him in the lineup. But what Ryan O'Hearn does bring you, and I think this has always kind of been his ceiling, is he's a left-handed power bat off the bench. And that's simply what Ryan O'Hearn should be. That in a game like yesterday, in the thin air, one bad pitch can give you the lead. Because Ryan O'Hearn, as he showed on Friday night, can put the ball into the bleachers. Now, does he do it all the time? No. But he's probably your best left-handed off-the-bench bat. He's the best option you can use in a pinch-hitting scenario when you need just one home run, because the Royals don't have a lot of power in general, he at least has some pop. But Ryan O'Hearn yesterday had his best at-bat of the season. Hell, might have been his best at-bat in the last 3 years. They're shifted on him, and Ryan O'Hearn went to the plate probably thinking, man, I can give us the lead right here, and everybody will be bowing down to me once we come back to Kansas City. I'll be the hero of this road trip, just like Emmanuel Rivera was in that series in Texas in game two, the bases clearing triple. But Ryan O'Hearn didn't try to hit the go-ahead home run. No, he did what very few Royals have done this year against the shift. He just sent a rocket the other way. And with nobody at third base, he hit a missile on the ground to left field. So it's first and second. Now the top of the lineup's coming up. And I'm starting to go, at least you're tying it. At least in this moment, you are tying the game. Whit Merrifield, who's been hotter, he comes up, but a very bad plate appearance. Pops up in foul territory, and you go, geez. Man, if not only did they give up seven in the bottom of the seventh, but if we don't score after putting the first two guys on in the one-run game in the ninth inning, now you're really starting to reel heading back to Kansas City. So Michael A. Taylor, who hits second because Andrew Benintendi had the day off. He comes up and not trying to do too much. He's not trying to be the guy to put it in left field. The left field bleachers, that is. He's not trying to be the guy that it's at 450 feet. No, he's just the next man up. And he works a walk, something that Michael A. Taylor, before he came to Kansas City, was not great at doing. And I'm not saying that he's been fantastic at it in Kansas City, but he's been better this year. He laid off a couple of close pitches. And then on 3-2, he watches one high and inside. So bases loaded, and here comes Salvador Perez. And Perez, as we all know, has not had a great start to the season. Had some blurry vision, went through an 0-for-28 stretch, was swinging at everything more so than he had in the past. I mean, he just simply wasn't seeing the ball out of the pitcher's hand. We'd never seen Salvi struggle this poorly. And yet he comes to the plate, and I'm watching the game on my couch with my roommate, and I turn to him and I say, there's only three things that can happen in this situation. Either a grand slam, a strikeout, or a double play. There will be no in-between, because that's just the type of hitter Salvador Perez is. He's going to be the all-or-nothing type of guy in a situation. He's usually not going to be the work the count, you know, lay off the close pitch. No, he wants to give the team the lead. That's what you pay Salvador Perez to do. And oddly enough, knowing that type of hitter, I guess Daniel Bard didn't. Daniel Bard had probably three or four pitches to work with in that at-bat. And I don't think he could have thrown, if I'm Daniel Bard, I wouldn't have thrown more than one in the zone. I would have started the at-bat with a slider. Now, Daniel Bard did not have great command of his slider in that inning. There was a couple of balls that simply were not even close. And behind the plate, you know, I think it was Nunez who was catching behind the plate. No, it was Elias Diaz. Elias Diaz was saving a lot of wild pitches. And one did get away from him, which allowed the Royals to put it at second and third with one out with Taylor at the plate, but Taylor walked. If you don't have the best command, still, I think there are other ways to work around Salvador Perez. But the first pitch he threw to Salvi was belt high, a little bit inside, and Salvi just roped it to left for a two RBI single. So I was wrong about Salvi, about what the outcome could be, because I truly believed in the thin air, either Daniel Bard's going to make a mistake or Salvi's going to be over anxious, a little overzealous, if I'm using that term correctly, and just swing at the first pitch. No matter where it is, he's going to try to either guide the ball into right on a pitch that's well away, down and away on a slider, or he's going to rip one somewhere, a fastball high, and he's going to hit it out. But it was a great approach. He wasn't trying to put the Royals up by three with a grand slam. He just got his pitch, a good line drive swing, and roped it into left and gave the Royals a one-run lead. Now, they had more chances to add on, but Carlos Santana couldn't get it done, and then Hunter Dozier, who still had a great series, couldn't get it done either. So now you're up by one. You had blown a six-run lead earlier with your bullpen, but you turned to Scott Barlow, and Barlow got it done on Friday night with a four-out save, and here he is once again against the 4, 5, and 6 hitters, trying to get Kansas City a series win and get back to Kansas City on a high note. And Colorado couldn't generate any solid contact off Scott Barlow, and he ends the game with a 3-pitch strikeout against Randall Grichuk, who had tied the game earlier in the 7th on a 2-run single. But it was the emotion the Royals showed after that game that I think is very telling. At Scott Barlow, he roars on the mound. He pounds his chest. Salvador Perez on the go-ahead hit, he's pumping up the dugout. He's pounding his chest. He's roaring. Even Damon Hollins, the first base coach, he's yelling. I mean, that was a big game for the Kansas City Royals. Whether you are positive about them in the moment, negative, kind of in between, the Royals so desperately needed that game. This isn't to say that the Royals are going to go on a tear of winning 9 of 10. They have two divisional opponents coming up in this homestand. They get the White Sox for 4, doubleheader tomorrow. They get the Minnesota Twins over the weekend. Then they go to Arizona, who's been great in the NL West, to start next week, and they ship back out to Minnesota for a weekend series against the Twins for the first one of the year at Target Field. But you're 12-20, and you just think about the difference in what one win at the tail end of a road trip, a very subpar road trip, can do coming back into a homestand. I mean, sure, it would have felt great to have Daniel Lynch get the win. He threw shutout ball. The Royals win 6-0, and you go, another shutout win. I think that would have been the Royals' third of the year. It's on the back of a very young pitcher who has been very good for the Royals. I don't think enough people at the moment are talking about Daniel Lynch because of how much of a disaster the Royals' rotation has been, excluding two guys. But Daniel Lynch so far this year has an ERA of 3.34 ERA of 3.30. In 30 innings, his whip is 1.3, struck out 29, he's 2-2. So Daniel Lynch, excluding one start in St. Louis, has been pretty good. Yeah, he's had some outings where he's not able to get out of the fourth inning. Pitch count's high, but man, yesterday in a tough ballpark to pitch in, Daniel Lynch was great. But he pitches well. Bobby Witt Jr. homers, Emmanuel Vera homers. He also has a RBI double. Defense was fine. Whit Merrifield, another two-hit game. Salvador Perez, I mean, up until the ninth inning, he wasn't hitting well, so it wouldn't have mattered. But you would have felt even better winning 6-0. But nonetheless, they win. If the Royals lose yesterday, 7-6, they blow a 6-run lead in one inning. Are many of you even tuning in tonight? Do any of you care what happens on the homestand if the Royals were to limp back at 11-21? A 3-6 road trip against a terrible Baltimore team, an underachieving Texas team, and a middle-of-the-road Colorado team. And now you got the White Sox in town. I mean, most of you would have said, I don't even care at this point. I'm not tuning in until something's done. And I do believe that if the Royals were to lose yesterday, somebody's job would have been on the line. Now, that shouldn't be, that one game shouldn't just be a problem solver, right? That shouldn't just guarantee the coaching staff's positions for the next 3 months, because the Royals very well tonight could play terribly, get shut out, and we're back in the cycle again. But baseball is about momentum. What can you do with momentum when it's at its highest point? And the Royals up to this point haven't had any momentum. They have the worst run differential in baseball, and yet they're 12-20. There are a lot of teams out there who have worse record than the Royals. The Tigers, for example, they're a game and a half back of the Royals. The Boston Red Sox are 13-21, so they're right around the same spot as the Royals. They have a higher winning percentage. The Washington Nationals have a worse record than the Royals. The Cincinnati Reds are 9-26. They're 13 games back of first place. I mean, there are other teams out there with a worse record than the Royals, but the run differential is telling you the Royals are even worse than what their record shows. So that tells you also there's been no momentum. The Royals have not put it together for back-to-back games since, what has it been, mid-April? I think the Royals have not won back-to-back games since mid-April. It's been ugly. But now you have this chance to use Sunday's game as a moment in this season to go on a tear. Not saying it's going to happen. It's now up to the players. But you feel like, even though it was Coors Field, even though it was the Mile High City, where offenses surge no matter how bad it is, the Royals needed to see some balls fly out of the yard. They needed to see some of those balls drop into the outfield grass. They needed to see those grounders sneak through the left side. They needed to win shootout games. They did it on Friday. They did it on Sunday. Now, on Saturday, it kind of felt like they just threw away the game by giving Carlos Hernandez another start. I don't know what the mentality was with that, but it seems like they just threw away another start. But you win the series. I'll take it. You were 4-5 on the road trip. But now we'll really get to see just what this Royals team can do with it. Bobby Witt Jr. starting to find his power. Emmanuel Vera has been a good replacement guy. He's hitting okay. MJ Melendez, though he didn't have the best road trip, I'm liking some of the plate appearances I'm seeing. I still want to see him in the lineup a little bit more. Kyle Isbell needs more at-bats. But guys are starting to turn it on a little bit. And that goes back to the Texas series, at least in game two. You know, in game one, they had a little bit of a spark late. In Baltimore, you had one game where the offense turned it on. But now playing Chicago, a White Sox team that has been truly, and I mean truly, a head-scratching case. They're always hurt, but they're 16-17. You won the first series of the year against the White Sox, and now you'll have Brad Keller on Monday. You likely will have, I want to say, John Heasley on Tuesday. Greinke's going on Wednesday. Well, the doubleheader will be John Heasley and then maybe Brady Singer would be my guess. I'm just speculating, but I feel like Brady Singer is going to join the rotation soon. This feels like the best opportunity to give him another start, maybe for the late doubleheader game on Tuesday. Greinke goes on Wednesday. I know we like to go series by series with this. Or excuse me, then the White Sox have, I think it's a five-game series. Now I think about it, the Royals do play the White Sox five times this week. Monday, two on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. Carlos Hernandez is slated to throw on Thursday for whatever reason. I don't know why. With his 0-3 and 9.11 ERA, kind of a head-scratcher at this point, but you go into this eight-game homestand, that is, against two divisional opponents. You're 12-20. What do we want to see in these eight games? 4-4 doesn't really get you anywhere. Though it's treading water, but the Royals are at a spot right now where it's about doing damage. When you're 12-20, you can't just be .500 on road trips, .500 on home series. Yeah, it will eventually get you to climb in the standings, but the Royals need a 5-3. It's only one game better. A 5-3 home stand against the White Sox and the Twins. Those are two teams that are in first and third place. Now, with the White Sox in a five-game series, you take 3 of 5, and I think that certainly is possible. I'm going to throw away the Carlos Hernandez start on Thursday, and I'm going to throw away the John Heasley start. But I feel good about Brad Keller tonight. I feel good about Zach Greinke on Wednesday going up against Vince Velasquez, who's 2-3 with a 5.53 ERA. And then I'm just speculating, I'm guessing, that Brady Singer throws one of the doubleheader games. I think you split the doubleheader. So there's a 3-2 series with the White Sox. Now for Minnesota, you take the series, you did it once, can you do it again? They're getting healthier, they're getting better, their pitching's better. Man, a 5-3 road trip really could do wonders for this team. Or a 5-3 homestand, excuse me. At 17-23, before heading off to Arizona, they'll take on the Diamondbacks, and then a weekend series against Minnesota. How would we feel at 17-23? Marco, as somebody that's seen this team through 32 games, you go 5-3 on the homestand against two divisional opponents. You're sitting 17-23. I doubt that bumps you into third place, but you're in fourth place, six games under .500. All I can really say at that point is it could be much worse. I'd feel okay with six games under .500 after this homestand.
I would too. I feel like that means there's some life with this team, and baseball is a long season, and you just hope for competitiveness if your team is not the favorites going into it. You hope that your team can remain competitive, especially within the division, but also just a team that gives you a little bit more hope to tune in each night, because like you said, it really is something where when in baseball, you almost have to win your fans over night in and night out just to get them to tune in. And so I think right there that would show me a little bit of hope, a little bit more fight. Maybe the Royals are starting to go kind of on the upward curve now of the season and kind of turn that ugly start into something a little bit better in the month of May. So I would be thrilled that the Royals finished at, we're at 17-23 heading out of the homestand that they're coming up on.
And you know, that'd be three consecutive series wins. You
yeah.
certainly would feel like they're on the upward trend of play. And I have hinted at the Royals are close to being on some sort of breakout, right? They're going to go on this stretch where they win a couple of series in a row. You want it to be now, though. You want to look back in May. You want to look back in June and July. If the Royals are inching closer to being 500 and being competitive, you want to use that Colorado game on Sunday as the turning point. Every competitive Royals team has had that turning point in the season. And you go back to 2013 and 2014. And when the light finally turned on, when the spark was ignited, you go back to 2014. It was right after the All-Star break. The Royals had lost. They had been swept at Boston. They had been swept at Fenway Park. The Royals didn't make a single move at the deadline. And they go and get swept with the same team they'd been playing with all year. Then a switch was flipped. A spark was ignited. And that was late in the season. The Royals turned it on. Not saying this team's going to make a wild card game. I'm not going to use one win, one emotional win. They still blew a 6-run lead. But that was an emotional win. I'm not going to put too much emotion into an emotional win. But it is one of those performances where you go, they could have folded. And the spot where they were this season, 11-20, a loss is just another loss at that point. It's a crushing loss, but a win showing that you can wipe away that bad inning and still come back, win, and then lock it down in the ninth. It shows some sort of passion and fight in the team. And I think it's been something that we've been looking for the first 2 months of the season. Now, a long ways to go, and this is going to be a very difficult homestand. Though the White Sox are under 500, the Twins are a first-place team, and the White Sox, in reality, should be a first-place team. A very tough homestand, but you go 5-3 over those 8 games. I'm feeling good at 17-23 before they head back out to the West Coast and take on Arizona. I guess, can you count Arizona as West Coast? Not really on the coast.
Southwest, yeah.
Southwest. I'll go to head out to the
inland.
Southwest.
Inland.
Yeah, a little bit inside, but yeah, I'll head out to the Southwest to take on the D-backs for, I believe, a 2-game series, and then they'll play. I think their off day is on Wednesday of next week. It is. So they'll have a 2-game series with Arizona on the road next Monday and Tuesday, off Wednesday, 4-game series in Minnesota starting on Thursday, May 26th, then a 2-game series on the road against Cleveland. So that's another. This stretch for the Royals is very important because their next homestand starts with Houston and Toronto, then Baltimore, then San Francisco on the road. So a tough month of June, it looks like, but it starts now. What will the Royals do after their emotional win yesterday against the Colorado Rockies, in which they took the series 2-1 after an 8-7 victory? When we come back here on The Shift, we don't do it a lot, but we have to today, talking some NBA basketball, couple of Game 7s, and then also some NHL talk, a wild night of a couple of Game 7s as well in the hockey world. You're listening to The Shift on 94.5 FM and 1510 AM ESPN Kansas City. Welcome back into The Shift on 94.5 FM and 1510 AM ESPN Kansas City. I'm your host, Jack Johnson, alongside Marco Marquez. We had a couple of Game 7s yesterday, and they did not go the way I expected. Not, I don't think you could have predicted this. And if you were given, I'm trying to fix how I say this. If you were given 10 opportunities to predict a final score of yesterday's Game 7s between the Boston Celtics, the Milwaukee Bucks, the Dallas Mavericks, and the Phoenix Suns, none of you would ever get it right. Or let's not even go the score. Let's go margin of defeat. Okay, because Game 7s, regardless of who is in it, are usually the primetime games to tune in. Even if you're not an NBA fan, you're a little bit interested in what happens in Game 7. Right, there's superstars on the court, there's storylines in both of those games, and there were yesterday. So the Boston Celtics at the Garden hosted Giannis Antetokounmpo and the Milwaukee Bucks. Game 7. The Celtics had forced a Game 7 a couple of days ago. The Bucks started the first quarter up 26-20. It was close at halftime, even though the Celtics outscored the Bucks by 11 in the second quarter. The Celtics won that game by 28 points. Game 7. The Boston Celtics handled Giannis and the Bucks by 28. The Bucks scored 81. They had two quarters with scoring less than 20. Giannis in the game had 25 points on 10 of 26 shooting. He also had 20 rebounds and 9 assists. Giannis had damn near a triple-double, and the Bucks nearly lost by 30. Jrue Holiday had 21 points. Brooke Lopez had 15 and 10. But Wesley Matthews had 3. Grayson Allen had 1, didn't make a shot from the floor. Bobby Portis only had 10. Pat Connaughton only had 2. And everybody else on the bench only had 2 or less. Now for Boston, it was incredible for who their leading scorer was, who had a plus 25 in the plus minus category. Grant Williams. Many of you know who Grant Williams is. I mean, if you keep up with the NBA, you do. But if you don't, you have no idea who Grant Williams is. He had 27 points, 6 boards, only 1 turnover. 39 minutes for Grant Williams. He led the Boston Celtics in scoring. Jason Tatum, the quote-unquote superstar of the team, had 23, 6, and 8. Did have 7 turnovers as well in 36 minutes. Jaylen Brown, 19 and 8 in 36 minutes. Marcus Smart, the former Okie State Cowboy, 11 points, 10 assists. Al Horford, only 6 points, 10 boards, 6 assists. Then off the bench, Peyton Pritchard. Peyton Pritchard out of Oregon gave the Boston Celtics 14 points on 4 of 6 shooting from 3-point range. I mean, nearly a 30-point win in Game 7 of the playoffs in the East region. A nearly 30-point win. Boston was a 4.5-point favorite. The under was hit at 205.5, largely in part because Milwaukee didn't score. But as I said in the show, I'm not going to shy away from it. I had Milwaukee in the finals. I had Milwaukee and the Golden State Warriors in the finals. Now, my Golden State pick is still a possibility because I have the Warriors winning it all. But I had the Bucks. I had the Bucks going back to the finals at least after winning last year, beating the Suns, and trying to make it back-to-back, running it back, as they say. But the Boston Celtics, though they were the higher seed, I didn't feel like they were the favorite because they didn't have Giannis Antetokounmpo. But yesterday showed that Boston is definitely a team not to be taken lightly. They eliminate the Milwaukee Bucks 109-81. Now, the late tip-off was about as shocking of a game as I've ever seen in the NBA. The Dallas Mavericks on the road against the number one seeded Phoenix Suns in the Valley. And I thought going into this game, no way in hell. No way in hell does Dallas win. Not that I'm saying Dallas is bad, but it just felt like Phoenix was primed to win at home in Game 7. This was Phoenix's year. You stumble, you fall a little bit short against Milwaukee. You come back, you're the number one seed. You dominate your way through the regular season. I mean, Phoenix was ridiculous in the regular season, 64-18. It's like the old Phoenix Suns teams back in the 90s. But this Suns team in Game 7 against the Dallas Mavericks, who are led by a 23-year-old by the name of Luka Doncic, lost by 33. They were down, by the way, by 45 at one point in Game 7 of the playoffs. And now it's the Dallas Mavericks taking on the Golden State Warriors in the Western Conference Finals with a chance to return to the NBA Finals. You know what's funny is the Golden State Warriors are a Bay Area team, and you'd think, you know, San Francisco Giants comparison. I think the Mavericks are very San Francisco Giants-like in baseball, that never the most talented, but they're always in the finals, it feels like, or they're always in the World Series. Remember that span from 2010 to 2020? It was every 2 years the Giants were in the World Series. Hmm. It was 2010, it was 2012, and it was 2014.
Won all three.
Yes.
Two.
It just feels like the Mavericks, I mean, dating back to when we were watching the NBA growing up, the Mavs were always there.
Yeah.
Never had the most talented team. They had Dirk. They had Jason Kidd at the tail end of his career. They had Jason Terry at the tail end of his career. I mean, it was like never a superstar. Sean Marion. Man, Josh Howard, I think, was on the old 06 Mavs team. I mean, J.J. Barea.
Yeah.
I mean, they never had the most talented team. But they were always able to take down a team like the Big Three in Miami. Or go toe-to-toe with the Spurs with Tim Duncan, Manu Ginobili, and Tony Parker.
Mm-hmm.
But last night, I mean, damn. Damn. It was 57-27 at halftime. Luka Doncic, who's my age, had the same amount of points at halftime that the Suns had. He had 27. He had 27 points, and the Suns had 27 points. It was never close at all. Not even really in the first quarter. It was 27-17 at the end of that. I mean, it was legitimately over at halftime. And then the Mavs didn't run out of gas in the third quarter. They piled it on. They outscored the Suns by 12. If it wasn't for the Suns outscoring the Mavs bench by 9 in the fourth quarter, this would have been the worst Game 7 blowout in NBA history. You actually, funny story, because Curtis Siebold tweeted this out, so I want to make sure I get this stat correctly. He was following along because he's a guy that wants to see history happen, as do the rest of us. But with last night's game, the Suns hit a garbage time three with 10 seconds left and then another at the buzzer to avoid tying the worst Game 7 home loss in NBA history. The worst home loss in Game 7 history is 39 by the 1948 St. Louis Bombers in the second year of the BAA. They weren't even calling it the NBA yet. The next worst was 27 by the Celtics against the Pacers in 05. That was Curtis Siebold last night tweeting that out, who is, of course, on the program with Seren Petro. It was the most jarring game I think I've ever seen. And Luka Doncic, to pour salt in the wound, it was always a back and forth with Devin Booker of the Suns and Luka Doncic. Luka Doncic had to be the most hated man in the Valley last night. Had to have been. Because not only the way that he played, I mean, he finished the game with 35 points, 12 of 19, shooting 10 boards, 4 assists, and played only 30 minutes. Didn't have to play the whole game. But I don't know if you saw this, Marco. I saw this clip this morning. Nearly after every shot Luka made, he was laughing. Laughing at the crowd, laughing at whoever was guarding him. I mean, it was like this diabolical player, this true villain that I think Luka is kind of stepping into. And I think it started a little bit in the regular season, but definitely this series. Luka has embraced that I don't care if I'm hated anymore. Because I think for a while, in the first parts of his career, when he was 18, 19, 20, Luka was this lovable guy because the Mavs sucked. And he was really good. And you get to see Luka a couple of times on primetime against the top teams, the Warriors, you know, the Bucks, you know, LeBron's Cavs. From time to time, you'd see Luka play, but the Mavs were never playing for anything. Kristaps Porzingis leaves, and the Mavs became one of the most deadliest teams. Jalen Brunson out of Virginia has been phenomenal. Dorian Finney-Smith, who for a long time I do not think was supposed to be considered what he is now. I mean, I don't want to put bust on Dorian Finney-Smith, but he had been playing all the way back since 2016. He had never averaged more than 10 points a game. And keep in mind, Dorian Finney-Smith, I want to say, was a first-round draft pick out of Florida. But the Mavs have pieced together this team that they're not a villainous team, but Luka Doncic is now a villain. And the way that he just went about his business last night, I mean, I think the last guy, the Suns didn't want to lose that game, obviously. I think as a fan, never want to lose at home in Game 7. I mean, that's stating the obvious. But it's how you lose, right? You never want to see the guy you've been hating all series just torch you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the head-to-head, the going back and forth, it's kind of like in Kansas City with the Chiefs and Tom Brady. You know, if you lose to Tom Brady, you're hoping Tom Brady doesn't throw for like 405 yards with 5 touchdowns and no picks. Because then, not only did you lose, they're going to compare Tom Brady to Patrick Mahomes and say Brady's better. It happened in the Super Bowl. It was the worst possible way the Chiefs could lose. You get hammered by the Bucks, and Tom Brady outplayed Patrick Mahomes. Though Patrick Mahomes had a terrible offensive line, I'm just pulling up the stats. Luka Doncic and Devin Booker yesterday went head-to-head in Game 7 of what was supposed to be a historic Game 7 playoff series. Doncic had 35. Devin Booker had 11 on 3 of 14 shooting. 4 turnovers. His plus-minus yesterday, minus 41. Luka Doncic, plus 37. It was incredible. A 33-point drubbing at home for the Phoenix Suns, who were on their way back to getting to the finals. Now, they still had a ways to go. They would have had to win the Western Conference Finals against the Golden State Warriors, a team that is historically great in the postseason. But, man, I mean, Marco, which one to you, I mean, I know what you're going to say, but which one to you is more shocking? Giannis getting beat by nearly 30 in Game 7?
Mm-hmm.
Or the Phoenix Suns, who won 64 games in the regular season, lose by 33 in Game 7 in the Valley?
Yeah, absolutely. It's the Phoenix Suns losing not only in a Game 7, but a series where they are up 2-0. And, you know, it was one of those where I was thinking this series isn't really – I mean, I don't think I watched a single game from this series, including last night's, because I just figured the Suns should be able to run away with this. They have what I thought was a pretty complete team that could very well compete against Golden State for a trip to the NBA Finals. I wasn't even paying attention to the conference semis. Hell, even the Grizzlies kind of took me back a step. And once again, we have seen just a stretch of playoff games of just almost perfect basketball between Ja Morant and Luka Doncic when they've been healthy in this playoff. So yeah, the Suns falling yesterday to Dallas was something that I didn't expect by how much they fell for and lost by. You're right. I wouldn't have been able to guess that margin of victory by Dallas yesterday. Now with Boston and Milwaukee, those were two really good basketball teams. Milwaukee was hurt with the loss of Chris Middleton, who got injured in the middle of the series. Boston, I felt like, was that team that over the last couple of years, especially when they had Jason Tatum, this was a team on the verge of making an NBA Finals at some point. When that time was going to come, who knows? But last year, they fell short, a series short, falling in the Eastern Conference Finals to Milwaukee. This year, they get the revenge. They set up a now championship series against... I was thinking the team that they're going to be playing next in the conference finals.
East or West?
East.
Oh,
the Celtics.
Miami.
Yeah, Miami. Thank you. Yeah. Miami. A team that went to the finals a couple of years ago against the Lakers in the bubble. I'm really excited to see what this Celtics team can do. This is going to be a really fun Eastern Conference final series between those two teams. Now, as for the Western Conference with Golden State and Dallas, let's see what happens. The Warriors, a team that was expected to be in the finals, now gets a little easier trip to it with the help of Dallas upsetting Phoenix. But can they follow that up now against a Golden State team who, you said, in recent history has been very successful, and they have pieces from those championship teams still left on this roster. Let's see what they can do. But Heat and Celtics, that's going to be get your popcorn ready type of basketball.
I feel like we're back in 2008 with the Heat, the Celtics, yeah, and the Dallas Mavericks in the Eastern Conference and Western Conference Finals.
Right.
The only thing that's missing would be the Lakers being in the place of the Golden State Warriors, but unfortunately the Lakers did not make the postseason. I'm sorry I had to bring that up,
that's
Marco.
All right.
But, you know, it's now all set. It's set for, I think it was what is going to be a great finals round. You'll have Miami and Boston going toe-to-toe, the number one seed and the number two seed. That's the one thing, is they feel like underdogs, but they're really not. Miami's the number one seed. Boston's the number two seed. Now Dallas is the four and the Warriors are the three, so the ones and twos were bounced from the Western Conference side. But I'm excited for this one. It'll all start on Tuesday night. It'll be Miami and Boston down in South Beach. Heat, a 1.5-point favorite, over-under at 203.5. Tip-off will be at 7:30 p.m. on ESPN. Then on Wednesday, it'll be game one of the Western Conference Finals. Dallas will be in the Bay Area against the Warriors. The Warriors are a 4.5-point favorite, over-under at 214.5. Tip-off is at 8 p.m. on TNT. We'll take a one-minute break, and when we come back, we will do some fact or fiction. You're listening to The Shift on 94.5 FM and 1510 AM ESPN Kansas City. Welcome back into The Shift on 94.5 FM and 1510 AM ESPN Kansas City. I'm your host, Jack Johnson, alongside Marco Marquez. Before we get to some fact or fiction, some news of yesterday and this morning around the NFL. Melvin Ingram will not be a Kansas City Chief this season. I know we were holding out hope, the slim hope, that he would return in a Chiefs uniform, but it will be the Miami Dolphins once again swooping in and taking another Chiefs player. Did it with Emmanuel Ogba back in 2020. Then Tyreek Hill became a Miami Dolphin this offseason, and now Melvin Ingram will join the Miami Dolphins in that defense that is going to get some, I guess, coverage this year. And when I mean coverage, I mean NFL Network's going to be talking about him, ESPN. I mean, it's not a defense that really should be taken lightly. Ogba and Ingram up front. You have Xavier Howard. Xavier Howard, right?
Yes, Xavier Howard.
Xavier Howard, yes. Honestly, I was like, Xavier Howard, that doesn't sound right. But yeah, this Miami Dolphins has a lot of star power on the defense. They got some star power on offense, Jalen Waddle and Tyreek Hill. The biggest problem, also up front, Terron Armstead, left tackle, they spent a lot of money for to protect the biggest problem for Miami, which is their quarterback. And then the other move of yesterday, the Packers and Jair Alexander have finalized a record four-year, $84 million deal, which makes him the highest-paid cornerback in the league. That cornerback market is getting much more expensive moving forward.
Makes sense why Veach made it an emphasis to build up that secondary with cheap labor.
Yep, and he always has, and I think he always will, as long as they turn out to be studs like Legarius Sneed had, Rashad Fenton has, Charvarius Ward, because then Charvarius Ward got paid. That's the way the Chiefs cornerback room is probably going to work. Maybe with the exclusion of Trent McDuffie. If Trent McDuffie becomes a Pro Bowler and is a cornerback number one, a number one cornerback from day one, he's going to be probably the first cornerback that Brett Veach pays a money, maybe not where Jair Alexander got, but a lot of money, because usually Brett Veach, he just lets them walk after their rookie deal is up. Now it is time for some Fact or Fiction. Five questions, five takes under 5 minutes. Marco, fire away.
Jack, Fact or Fiction, the Royals go 5-3 on this week's homestand.
That might be too optimistic. I really feel like I probably think closer to 4-4, maybe 3-5. I want to say that Sunday is an emotional win that can fuel you. But I also said they were going to get swept in Colorado, then they took 2 of 3. So maybe the more I stay optimistic about this team on the air, the worse they do, and the more pessimistic I am, the better they do. So I think I'll lock it in at 4-4. Still want to see 5-3, though.
Brady Singer starts at some point this week.
Fact. I mean, he's got a great chance to start on Tuesday night in game 2 of the doubleheader. If Carlos Hernandez gets another start on Thursday, I mean, I'm simply at a loss of words. Mm-hmm. I legitimately feel like the Royals threw away a game on Saturday by putting Carlos Hernandez on the bump in a ballpark that is not going to be favorable to him. It's not even favorable to a guy like Jacob deGrom or Max Scherzer.
Yeah.
But Carlos Hernandez is like the one pitcher in Major League Baseball you just don't want throwing at Coors Field. And they threw him out there again. He gave up 9 runs in less than 5 innings. So if he doesn't start on Tuesday night, I'd imagine he starts in front of Carlos Hernandez on Thursday.
Heat and Celtics go into 7 games.
Fiction. I think that actually Boston wins this series. Mm-hmm. I like Miami a lot. I really do, and I want to see Miami win because I don't want to see Boston back in the finals. But, man, from what Boston showed against Milwaukee, who I consider to be a top – I mean, it's not really a shock in saying the Bucks were a top 2 team. I mean, they were the 3 seed. But when you have Giannis and you stop Giannis for – I mean, I guess the way you did stop him, you didn't hold him to under 40 points in a couple of games, but you still won. You won in 7 games, and Miami doesn't have a player like Giannis. They've got Jimmy Butler. They're a little bit more well-balanced. The Heat are banged up, though, too. I just see Boston be able to take care of this series in about 6 games.
Fact or fiction, Luka Doncic wins at least 1 championship in Dallas.
This may be his best chance, because we always want to think when young teams, they make a run like this, we say, oh, well, they'll be back again. I mean, we think with the Cincinnati Bengals, you thought it with the Chiefs, you thought it with, I mean, throw a team out there that started young and made it back. I think the Warriors are one of the few teams that when they were young, they just continued to go back. I'm going to go fiction, though. I don't see him winning 1 in Dallas. I might see him winning somewhere elsewhere unless he just stays a Maverick his entire career.
And lastly, fact or fiction, KC, Kansas City, gets a hockey team before 2030.
Yeah, there were some entertaining games last night. I didn't get to it. The Penguins lost in overtime to the Rangers 4-3. That was a thrilling game. And then Calgary came back and beat the Dallas Stars. So a kind of wishy-washy night for Dallas fans. They get the Mavs in the finals, but the Dallas Stars fall short in Game 7 as well. Man, I think Kansas City's prime for an NHL team more than they are with an NBA team just because of the way T-Mobile Center is built. Before 2030, though, I'm not going to be that optimistic. I'm going to go fiction. I'm just going to wait and see on that type of product because I don't know who simply they would be getting. There is Ray Charles, so it means it's time to go. That wraps up another edition of The Shift on 94.5 FM and 1510 AM ESPN Kansas City. I've been your host, Jack Johnson, alongside Marco Marquez. We'll see you tomorrow at 10 a.m. You take it easy, Kansas City.